And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis, your host, and we have Tom Reed coming up in the first hour, and he's going to be talking about being inducted in the Great Barrington Historical Society, about his case, his family case. That's kind of interesting and exciting. So he'll be coming up in the first hour. In the second hour, it's kind of a strange thing. We've never tried anything like this. We have Randall Nickerson. He's going to be live streaming from his own website, and he's going to have a chat room on his own website that's being set up right now with questions and answers about his new documentary. And that is for the Ariel School phenomenon. And that'll be in the second hour. That's only going on for about a half an hour. So at 9:30, we're going to be taking calls. And that is at the number 603-967-4030. I'll be giving that number out again as we go along. Now, Randy's chat room is on his own website. That link is right on our website, so you can go right to it. It's too long for me to tell you what it is. But that's not to be confused with our own chat room right on our sidebar. Go to podcastufo.com, and you'll see our own chat bar that you can talk to the guest in the first hour right there. Okay, and I want to thank everyone who's helping us by supporting the show and subscribing to us. It's only a dollar a month or more to hear the second half of the show. You can go to our website again, and all that information's right there. And we have that all set up for iTunes and all kinds of other media players. So you're going to be all set with whatever you have, except Stitcher. We can't figure that part out. So I want to thank everyone again for listening, whether you're supporting us or not. Each and every one of you is very important to us. And now we're ready to roll in the news with Alejandro Rojas from Open Minds. How are you, Alejandro?
Good. Am I important to you, too?
Somewhat. Yes, of course you are.
Oh, I wanted to hear it.
You are. Hugs.
I knew it, but I wanted to hear it.
Can we have a digital hug here?
Yeah, here we go. There you go, buddy.
Yeah, that was a good one. So we got to squeeze through the news kind of fast this week. So what's going on?
Let's do it. So one of the stories we wrote about recently is from 2013, but it's taken MUFON that long to analyze it. No, actually, the MUFON Scientific Board puts out an annual report on the top cases. And they're backed up, so they just got the 2013 top cases out. And one of the top cases includes a video, and everybody loves videos. So I posted what was essentially their idea of the best UFO video from 2013. It shows a bright light and a smaller light dropping out of it that's blinking. The light kind of moves up and then moves out, down and out of sight quickly. And this was in Boise, Idaho, December 24th, 2013. It was about 9 p.m. And so the video is interesting. It was taken by a couple who had spotted it while they're driving. So they stopped, rushed home to get their camera, and were able to catch this orb coming out of it. They said they saw another similar thing prior to this. But what's really interesting about this case is that there were two other groups of people that saw the same thing that evening, and they reported pretty much exactly the same thing, seeing this bright red light with this other light coming down and dropping out of the bottom. The second set of people were some people out driving around looking at Christmas lights who saw it. And then the third set was a mother, a stay-at-home mom, who was went outside to have a smoke and saw this, and she called her kids to come out and watch it with her. So pretty interesting. It finally was It was investigated. He couldn't find any local airport or Air National Guard or anything who could determine what it was. A really interesting case. What's more interesting is that MUFON's Roger Marsh, who posts sightings on openminds.tv, posted a sighting this week from Oregon. And this was on March 4th at about 8:15 p.m. Just this year, so just the other day, and a very similar description, this object that was hovering there and a smaller object coming out of it. So pretty interesting that this similar report came from similar to the 2013 one.
Yes, and I know all these stories are linked in our show notes to your website, but I do want to say that if someone goes to podcastufo.com, right on the homepage or in our show notes, you will see that video that you were talking about in Boise, Idaho. And that is, I always get a thrill out of seeing those UFOs when the thing drops out of them or more than one thing drops out of them. I mean, that makes it even more unexplainable, but in a way, it's almost like a drone type of situation. I mean, it kind of makes some type of sense.
Well, that a drone would have something dropping out of it and kind of coming back up and dropping down again?
No, meaning the it's like a drone dropping out of the larger
object. So it's really weird. Definitely a weird case. And these days, video isn't enough. You need that good witness testimony. And especially to have multiple witnesses is a great thing. So really interesting case.
Right. And so what else is going on?
A couple other videos. There's a lot of people who have seen this Argentina TV station with a UFO in the background.
Oh, yeah.
That's created a lot of buzz. However, unfortunately, it turned out to be a hoax. So,
how did they hoax that?
Well, you just replace the video in the background. They added. So Lee Spiegel wrote about it, and the TV station got a hold of Lee Spiegel and said, here's the real video from our newscast. And he provided them with the video of that segment of the newscast, and you don't see a UFO in the background.
Oh,
so somebody, CGI'd that UFO in the background, unfortunately.
And so, it looks really good, too.
Yeah, it looks really good. It was a really interesting one, but that turned out to be a hoax. Wah, wah.
Wah.
Another one that is a suspected hoax, but nobody's quite sure yet, is one that is out of California in the Silicon Valley. This is a video that was taken on March 5th, so it's also recent, and this was taken with a drone. So this drone is flying around. It has a 4K camera on it, and it caught something whipping by. The drone was about at 265 feet, and it's a really kind of interesting video. It's a kind of a shocking video.
It is. So, now, has anyone explored – don't yell at me when I say this, but has anyone thought about an insect? I did watch the video.
Of course people have thought an insect.
You know what I mean? Like flying real fast.
I won't yell at you. I'll just be condescending.
Okay, duh. That's good. I'm used to that.
Yeah. No, but yeah, there's a lot of people. There's a guy in one of the California MUFON guys thinks it might be CGI because he thinks that he sees it disappear here and there. However, others feel that it could be, well, a lot of people feel it's a genuine UFO. Some people think a bird. Some people think a bug. A lot of the MUFON guys, including the STAR team head and Mark D'Antonio, the photo analyst, feel that it's probably a bug. And I think that it might be a bug. I think when people look at it, it looks so white. It's white and it looks kind of stunning, so they think, oh, it's definitely not a bug. But I think a bug zooming by the camera that's, you know, illuminated could look like this. So it could be a bug, and I'm kind of leaning that way myself.
Yeah, and it's awful hard, even though that was a 4K camera, it's awful hard to do a frame by frame on that. I tried to do that frame by frame on YouTube, and it's not easy.
No, even though it's 4K high resolution, this thing's so small, moving so fast. In our story, Jason, who wrote it, put a still so you could see. And even at 4K, it's difficult to make anything out.
Righto. Well, I know you did a great job blazing through the news this week. And so we just want to make sure we get a pretty good hour in with Tom. And thanks so much. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
And we can chat more and have more fun next week, possibly.
All right. Hopefully.
Yeah. All right. So thanks so much. And everyone, if you hang in there, we'll be right back with Tom Reed right after this quick music break. tune was by Bruce Rainier. And how you doing, Tom Reed?
Very good. I appreciate you having me on.
It was a pleasure, and it was a pleasure to meet you out in Phoenix. Unfortunately, you didn't get to record for our live show, but here you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a tough couple of days. My plane was grounded for 2 days. I got in, did my PowerPoint on 2 hours sleep, and had to get some rest. And by the time I was up and moving around, you were gone. So,
well, I'll tell you, no one had any idea that you had 2 hours sleep. I'll tell you that. You did a great presentation.
Oh, did you watch it?
Yeah, I watched most of it.
Oh, and thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty big crowd.
Yeah, it was packed.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. So, and I wanted to congratulate you because I guess it happened while you and I were communicating back and forth before the Phoenix conference that you were, in, your story was inducted into the Great Barrington Historical Society. And so how do you feel about that? That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, they actually have been talking about it for quite some time, being that our case was given a I'll tell you how it led up to it. Our case was given a CE classification in September of 1969 in Great Barrington. It was actually reported by several at, well, I say several, it was like nine people, I think, that gave testimony from South Egremont, some from the Juggin Resort. There were an awful lot in Sheffield that saw the craft. And our local bistro, Village on the Green, which, by the way, is still there today, it became like a gathering spot for people to talk about it because it was really the only restaurant, you know, big restaurant in Sheffield. So a lot of people, the town constables, people across the street in the gas stations would come in, everybody would talk about it. So it was never something that was like whispered. I mean, it was very well known back then. And then it went out on WSBS radio, whose letter has been hanging in Roswell for quite some time. And that's still under the same call letters as well. And South Egremont Country Club is still South Egremont Country Club. So our house is still there. And at one point, the town had a time capsule. They buried all the people's names in town. So they took, you know, everybody's that lived their age and everything, and they put together this time capsule, and they buried it. So you have WSBS Radio is still there under the same call letters who announced our case, or announced the craft, I should say, back in September of 1969. It was given a Hynek classification back then during the years of Project Blue Book. That doesn't mean it is Project Blue Book, but it was given a Hynek classification during those last 3 months. And then our restaurant is still there, and our house is still there. So I think with all the witnesses and the polygraph tests and the people talking about it still today, it was something that they were contemplating for quite some time. And last I knew, it really wasn't supposed to happen until Labor Day, the weekend this September, which would be the anniversary of it. But some kids, I guess, at Simon's Rock Early College, and I guess it was the Daniel Art Center, someone from Daniel Art Center was actually interested in it. So the town really got behind it. And so there was a vote, you know, did we wait till September or induct it? And it went through on February 6th. And I couldn't be happier. I mean, to me, it says a lot for a lot of reasons. And one of those reasons, and a lot of people don't know this either, is that I was nearly killed in December of 2005. And my father actually came out to Florida to be by my side and took some time off. He was a principal at the time. He had gotten out of politics and stepped down as an attorney. And we had always talked about doing this book and in writing about the things that he had gotten back from Robert Bletchman and friends and that sort of thing that were filtered to him after this United Nations thing back in 1992. He had a lot of documents back then, papers, who knows what he had. I mean, but he had an awful lot. He had a lot from Sign and, you know, Blue Book and all the other ones and letters from the Greece Ministry, Defense, the Pentagon, you know, a lot of stuff that probably you don't see a lot, whether it was really powerful documentation, I couldn't tell you. But I have a lot of it, but I don't know what I'm reading, to be honest with you. So anyway, so when he came down to Florida to see me, he brought some of the stuff with him, had entertained the thought of, well, listen, when you get back on your feet, we really need to do this book. Because I think at one point when he said, when the time is right, Tom, you know, we'll put this book together. And now that I almost died, maybe he thought, well, this would be either conversation or that he really meant it or what have you. So after I got back on my feet, I really pushed him to write this book with me. You know, hey, you came down, let's do it. I'm going to be laid up for a while. I'm running around on crutches. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got plenty of time. What do you say? Start it, you edit it, that kind of thing. And it was October, and he went to school. His head hit the desk. He was rushed to Yale New Haven Hospital, and he had a nasty fungus going through his blood. The mayor of Bridgeport called in the CDC. They came in from Atlanta. They shut down his building immediately. Jeez. And my father died that day.
Oh, my God.
He died on the same day that our case got mentioned. It wasn't a front runner, just got some slight mention at the United Nations through our retained lawyer. We retained Robert Bletchman legally. And he mentioned our case at the UN in support of 33-426. 14 years later, after talking the book, my father dies on that same day.
Wow.
And so that, to me, is why and why my mother, brother, and we all have decided to step out and talk about this more. Because until then, you know, we feel that would have gotten lost in the shuffle. But now that we have a real heartfelt purpose for it, and with this induction into the Historical Society, as far as I'm concerned, you know, this pays tribute to my late father. I mean, this is for him. And so for that, I'm honored and very grateful, because I think that we were able to show that this powerful individual who has a proclamation in his honor, a bench in the city green, that was a respected attorney, when he would talk about the UFO topic, you know, some people would take that. That having the case now inducted, I think, really speaks loudly and adds credibility to what he was trying to do and what he was saying.
Wow. I do want to talk about that, about your father and about the rest of your family in this case, your brother and all. But we have a message board, and there is a question posted up there.
Sure.
And at the UFO Congress, this was someone that was there who I actually met. He's a listener to the show. You mentioned that 9 of your family members are Rh negative.
Mm-hmm.
In your own words, for those not familiar with Rh negative and the UFO abductions, what is the significance of this?
Well, I can tell you that's like almost a twofold question. In my opinion, I believe that man was originally Rh negative. I say that because anybody Rh positive has a link to the monkey. There's a connection to the rhesus monkey. Whereas Rh negative, there is no link to anything else. There is no beginning to, and you can't link it to anything. And it's a cleaner cell. The cleaner Rh negative is much cleaner than Rh positive because it lacks certain coppers and sugars and that sort of thing. Now, secondly, Time Life did a test on those who were Rh negative and found that the common denominator was, when testing for remote viewing, the Rh negative, those with Rh negative blood groups tend to test higher than those who had Rh positive.
Really?
Now, there's more to it. O negative blood types, which is Rh negative, O negative, was the only blood type that was really tracked by the U.S. government back in the 60s, because it was the universal donor during the years of NAM. Anybody can receive O negative blood. Anybody.
Hmm.
But someone with Rh negative or O negative blood can only receive O negative blood, because it's in some respects, I'm not sure if the word pure is really the word for it, but there was absolutely nothing on it, on the cell itself, that your body will reject. Now, if you're Rh negative and you are having an Rh positive child, an Rh negative mother will actually, her body will go into a state where it'll attempt to abort that baby because it sees it as a foreign object.
Right.
So when you look at that, it's almost, I don't want to go too far out on a limb here, but it's almost like we're a different type of human being. When your body wants to reject another human that should be human, but the other thing too, you know, Rh negative, my body temperature doesn't run at 98.7. My body temperature runs at 97.1.
Hmm.
And 98.7, I got a point and a half temperature. So
yeah.
I run at a different temperature. O negative have tested to be more intuitive or with regard to testing. My blood pressure runs lower. Blood temperature runs lower. You have a child, if it's Rh positive, it's looked at as a foreign substance. So maybe there's more here. But I believe that that O negative or Rh negative blood groups were the original blood of man. I believe that. I could be wrong, but that's what I believe.
Have you ever looked into any of the scientific facts about that?
No, I haven't spent a lot of time with it. I'm pretty occupied with other things, but I'm starting to look into it more and more.
Mm-hmm. We have another question up there, and that is, your brother Matt had physical trace marks on his chest.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any physical trace marks on yourself?
I just had this scoop mark thing on my right arm that so many people have alluded to the fact that that's a typical scoop mark. It's pretty big. It's larger than a pencil eraser. It's quite deep, and I've had it since I was about 6 or 7 years old, and it's almost perfectly round, and it never tans. I've never seen a scar. I just remember having it since I was a child.
Yeah, it seems like the scoop mark. I remember you talking about that. Let's see. Did Matt shave his chest for the photo, or did the aliens? And that is a goofy question, says he.
No, when he went in to have it looked at by Dr. Mazzello, they shaved it. And it looked like his little wounds looked like sugar cones, like little, you know, they were flanged out on top. They were actually fairly big when you really think about it for what they were. They weren't just like a needle puncture. I mean, I think they were 3 centimeters, if I'm not mistaken. I've got the doctor's report here somewhere, but they were fairly large, and they looked like miniature sugar cones with a little bit of a flange on the outside, and it was very strange. There was talk from the doctor that if you were trying to reach the thymus gland, that would have been the spot where you would have inserted a needle. And then it was, well, why would you want to go to the thymus gland? Well, there is a sac off to the side of it, which is where your body produces the T cells for your immune system. Now, most people will, or doctors will attest and make you aware that by the time you're an adult, most of those cells are dried up, those T cells. But if you wanted to extract something about that, something that would build your immune system, you could still get whatever you wanted from that sac, whether or not the T cells were still being manufactured or not, it's still there. So there was that became a topic for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, who knows? But it wasn't a peculiar spot in the direct location would have been that sac that produces the T cells.
Hmm. You know, I think I'm being a little bit rude to the listener that may not know about your case. So if you would, kind of in a nutshell, can we talk about your early childhood, how this whole thing started and where it progressed and progressing?
Yeah, sure. We had an 80-acre horse farm in Sheffield, Massachusetts, which was pretty rural. It was out in the tri-state area, nestled, if you will, between New York, Connecticut, and that little corner of Massachusetts, not far from where Norman Rockwell's brush first touched a canvas.
The Berkshire area.
Yeah, you know, music in Tanglewood, you know, that kind of thing. And we, like I said, we had a large spread of land, and our house was pretty much on the top part of it. Now, a lot of people don't realize this, and I mentioned it at the Congress, that Sheffield is one of the highest locations for a 1,700-mile stretch of road.
Huh.
It's almost 3,000 feet high. Beckett's 3,000 feet high. And our house basically sat, if you look at the pictures, pretty much up on top of that. And so it's been speculated that because we had the highest or one of the highest elevations, that, you know, there could have, you know, there could have been some testing and that sort of thing up there. When you look at, you know, Pratt & Whitney was only 55 miles away. Command Aerospace was 40 miles away. This is by road. GE was only 19 miles away. You had the Groton Naval Base making nuclear submarines that weren't far away. And so you had a lot of military around this mountain. That's not even talking about Albany and everything. That's just Massachusetts and Connecticut. And so we're, here we are with the highest elevation with a house on top of it. And on top of that hill, if you went down, there were valleys. And so, you know, maybe that is part of, maybe that took, or played a role in what happened with us. Really hard to say, but we had seen a craft in 1966, and it was on our property, the back side of the property, not too far from the house, maybe 400 yards from the house, and maybe a little more than that, just past a tree line. In 67, we saw it a second time, and that was when my mother got involved with. Alien Mysteries did a pretty good job on that one. My mother comes running out and grabbed us out of the road, and we were pale. We weren't really speaking to each other. We were really kind of out of it. And I remember staring at my brother, and I remember my mother coming out and grabbing him. But as far as my demeanor, I guess if you were looking in from the outside, I looked to be just placid and out of it and very unresponsive. Yet I remember things pretty clearly, just as my brother did. He wasn't really responding, but we, for some reason, seemed to be in this state where we were, our bodies seemed to be manipulated or just like this dead, you know, look to ourselves and not really moving. Yet our insides, our brain and our eyes and thoughts were moving. You know, we were thinking, we were able to respond if we, in a way, but our bodies wouldn't. You know, it was almost like we were combined to a shell or a mannequin, but we were alive in it. It was really weird.
Hmm.
And so my mother grabbed my son, my younger brother Matthew, grabbed me. And so she grabbed her sons, brought her, ran us into the house, sat us at the dining room table, and gave us aspirin and orange juice. And we slept in the living room next to a fireplace. We slept on the sofas. Mother stayed with us that night, and what we remember from that night was, you know, we remember, you know, seeing this craft that really looked more like a tarnished or dirty turtle shell, and it was laying on the ground. Didn't see any gear, didn't see any windows. We, you know, it looked, but it was huge. It was about 15 to 18 feet high, and it was probably 40 to 60 feet around, and it had a lip around it. Almost like a tire lip, not made of rubber, but I mean, it had a lip around it that you would reference as, you know, almost like a, if you ever had a 10-speed bike, you know, you had those thin rubber lips for the tires,
mm-hmm.
almost something like that, a big lip like that that wrapped around the front of it and the back, I mean, like circled it. And it wasn't at the bottom part kind of taped it back in, but there was this big round lip that went around it, and it almost looked like it had sections to it or lines in it. I'm not going to say it was panels, but there was some lines through it, and it wasn't silver. It was more like a bronze with a almost a maybe like a like a pewter, maybe kind of a.
A sort of weather, a little bit of a silvery, or
yeah, like a burned pewter, or like a bronzy pewter that blended into. It wasn't an even color, and I asked myself, was it the light? You know, was it the sunlight? Was it making reflecting differently? But it did not resonate the same color. It seemed to have different tints in it. I guess if you took a blowtorch to it, you know, sometimes you got that orangey bronze look, and then here it's a little lighter. That's the way it looked. It looked very weathered to me. And it was big. And we remember the inside of it. I remember a inside that was probably about the size of a master bedroom, a hall, like a squared-off area. I was escorted out this room. I was going right out the front. I took a right down this hallway that wrapped around like a question mark. I had passed my brother, who was standing there very placid again, yet he remembers seeing me clearly, but to me, he looked like he was almost asleep standing up. And I was taken around him, and he had a figure next to him, too. Every time we had somebody next to us or that was with us during this time, they were always on our left side. And it was almost like we got escorted and there were zones. So I was taken up this winding area that wrapped to the right and came back around. And when I got to the front of it, this individual that was with me left, and this new person or entity or what have you was now responsible for me. That's the way it appeared. And then I was taken into this darker room where I saw what was very dark, and a screen that had come up that went wrapped from 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock, and this was just a beautiful shot of a lake and a willow tree, and it was moving, and it was beautiful and chanting, and it was just totally took my mind off my brother, and it just, I'll never forget it. I mean, the willow tree was moving, and wind was coming.
Whoops. Hello?
Yeah, I thought you were recording. I wasn't going to say anything.
That's okay. I am recording. And Tom, are you there?
Yeah, what happened?
We're back. We're actually going to go live. So just hold that thought. And I'm recording all this, so the podcast is going to hear all this, what we're going through. So, Keith, anytime you want to fire us into the live, we're ready to go.
Should I keep talking?
Yeah, sure. Is that okay, Keith?
Yeah, hold on here.
Power's back?
Yeah. So if you want to just hold that thought for a minute, we'll just, once we know power is on, I'm just going to say something to the live listener real quickly.
Okay.
Okay, you can go live anytime.
All right, let's go now. All right, so if you're listening live, we're just right back, or where the power was out at the Dark Matter Radio Network. So the power's back on, and we were right in the middle of a conversation, Tom. Do you remember where you left off?
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to back up a little bit just in case, because it went down for a few minutes. Anyway, I was talking about inside what this craft was that was near our property that was in 1967, and it's one of the, it's the second to the second of three that were seen in our property that made so much local noise. And like I said, I remember this hallway that wrapped almost like a question mark, and it really did. It kind of, where the, I guess the circle would be at the bottom of the question mark was really a square room or a squared off room. And not perfectly square, but softly rounded square area. And I was taken out that into what would be the bottom of the question mark. And when I wrapped to the right and wrapped around in it, to me, it really did resemble a question mark. And I passed my brother and got to the front of this area, and I was released, for lack of a better word, and at that point handed off to someone else, which I believe was now responsible for me. And shown this room that was much darker. It had a couple of tables in it. There was a screen, like I said, it lit up with a big image of a tree, a willow tree off to the left, and a big bay of water. And to give you an idea, well, we had a black and white television back then. This is 1967. This visual would be like taking maybe 20 60-inch plasma TVs, stacking them all on top of each other, and having it be one screen. That vivid, that big, that crisp. It was just absolutely amazing. And I was just staring at this thing. I didn't know if I was looking out some strange window, if I was looking. I had no idea what to make of it. But it was night out, And this thing was just like I was looking over a beautiful lake. It was this moving willow tree in sunlight. And my brother was with me, and it kind of took my mind off that, obviously. And it wasn't much more than that. There were a couple individuals working on some lower tables that were bronze or brown. They were not silver or chrome. And some markings on top, and you know, if I remember correctly. Then to the left of me looked like it had, I'd say, almost like a second tier or some type of a second story area there. It looked like glass of some sort off to the left, and almost like brick glass, you know, those square glass pieces. And then I was brought back to the driveway where my mother came running out of the house and scooped us up and brought us into the house and cared for us with blankets and everything else. And
now, was there missing time according to what you thought? And another thing, how old were you when this happened?
7.
So what did you make of it? I mean, how could you possibly wrap your brain around what you just experienced? Are you okay?
Yeah, I got a little bit of a sore throat, so.
Yeah. Don't die on me, because we don't want anyone dying on this show.
I've been killed long ago.
We don't want anyone dying on a live show. Yeah. So.
Can't edit that out.
So you're 7 years old. You have this beyond amazing thing happen. So your mother scooped you up in the driveway. Did she call the police, or what happened at that point?
Well, when we were gone, she had actually saddled up her horses and ran all over the property for us, turned on the floodlights. My grandmother came out onto the screen porch. We didn't have neighbors. So, and this was a dirt road out of the middle of nowhere. And like I said, we had 80 acres, just to give you an idea. And our closest neighbor, was probably a quarter of a mile. So she found us. I mean, she was on her horse, and she was up towards the top of the property. We had hay baler, and we weren't allowed to go past the hay baler thing. So, you know, she had seen the flashes of light. You know, she had known something was going on. And she wasn't kind of a novice to it. She knew something was happening. And so she just went up high on the hill and decided to look down, which would make sense. And then she saw us all of a sudden staring at my brother and I staring at each other. He was lower than me in the lower part of the driveway, and I was on a little bit of a hill up near the stable. And my grandmother was on the screen porch, and then all of a sudden she yells, and my mother hears her and then runs down on the horse and jumps off and scoops up my little brother and scoops up me, rushes us in the house, you know, like I said, sits us at the table, gives us a baby aspirin juice, and we sleep in the living room. Now, did she call anybody? No, not that night. I don't think she did. She might have called a friend or two, but nothing to report. But when we went back to school and she opened up the restaurant, and more times than not, I actually rode with my mother to the Village on the Green restaurant, and I would open it with her. And we would, have breakfast and all the other kids in town and, our restaurant was walking distance from the school. So if your parents were driving to work, they'd drop the kids off at the restaurant. My mother would make them breakfast. You know, at the end of the week, they'd square the bill away, and all the kids would run across the street to the school. So, and when I say go across the street to the school, I mean it was like walking basically just across a four-lane road, and you were at the school. So, and they had a crossing guard. So after school, everyone hung out there too. So it became the hub, and a lot of people were talking, but at this point, not the whole town had seen anything. So it was more like a private conversation with those who came in, you know, hey, Nancy, what's going on, you know, because they could tell something was wrong. And so that went on for quite a while. I mean, I'd say for almost a year, it became something that was like whispered, you know, on the lips of my mother and us at the school, and the restaurant. And it wasn't until 1969, which really changed everything. That was the account that went out on WSBS Radio, whose letters in Roswell, at September of 1969. And that was witnessed by those from Jug End Resort and a lot of people in the area. and they saw the craft performing acrobatical movements unknown to conventional aircraft and hovering about 500 feet over our farm. Now, it didn't used to be the Reed farm. It used to be the Burroughs farm, because my mother got married afterwards. So it was the Burroughs farm. But it was our farm. And because of the HINET classification and WSBS radio being there and our restaurant still being there and the Historical Society getting a lot of calls about this because it's still talked about today as how it got inducted into the Historical Society. But as far as what we saw that night, I was leaving Butternut Basin Ski Resort. I was riding at a 4-H show, and my saddle had come loose. And so we left early, and so I didn't do so well. I got a brown ribbon. And they took me to the Meadows restaurant to eat. And then after that, we had my mother decided to go down to Village on the Green to make the night deposit drop because our cook had been locking up because it was Labor Day weekend. My grandmother, who normally would have run it, was with us while I was in competition. So she went to make the night deposit drop, made sure the chairs were all up, places locked up, went to the bank, made the deposit, and now we're heading back towards Great Barrington. And a shortcut to get to the home would have been over the Sheffield Bridge, and so that's what she did. My mother took a shortcut over the Sheffield Bridge, which is basically very swampy, you know, willow tree type of scenario, you know, very marshy, and a lot of open land. My grandmother turned around as I was sitting in the back seat, and I was going to give my brother a fireball. And she had turned basically to tell me that he could choke on it. He was too young, but I was only nine. I'm nine, and he was like seven. And she just didn't think it was a good idea. And sure enough, you see the lights out the back side of the car on the left side, kind of off where I was sitting in the back seat. And then my mother says that the car had come off the right side of the road in a stall. She really doesn't know if she panicked and flooded it or I don't know. All she knows is that it came off to the right. You could hear the stones tapping underneath the gas tank and the fender walls, and it was like driving over eggshells. It was that kind of a calm, that kind of a dead. And it just went completely silent. It's almost like it was surreal. And then we had this tingling feeling, and which later on we've associated with ELF. But it was just a very strange feeling. Your body picked up on it. It was not something that you were accustomed to. And then, bang, there was an eruption of crickets and katydids, and everything just changed. It was like being in the middle of a hurricane. You could feel the barometric change in pressure, and boom, we're no longer in the car. And we were separated, and wherever this was, I was in what looked like almost like an airplane hangar. The only way I can describe it, it was that kind of big and open, and there were carts next to me. There were two silver carts. I don't know if they had wheels or not, but there were two chrome-looking carts that were maybe 4 feet high. And aside from that, I believe it was empty. And then there was a light that I began to see ahead of me, and I don't know if the door opened left or it opened right or however it did, but a light came in, and there was a person or what looked resembled a frail person standing there. And for the first time, I was actually very scared. I was very nervous. This wasn't something where I was engulfed or engaged and having my mind manipulated through ELF or stimulating neurons in my head or whatever was happening. I didn't have this calm about me. And I walked, believe it or not, I don't know why, but I walked towards this person, and I was grabbed really hard on my left arm. I mean hard, like it hurt, and taken out this hallway off to the right. And I went down another hallway, which teed off to the left. These were not windy halls, not this part of it. These were very left and right. And I would say maybe this first hallway that I went down, maybe 20 feet, and then I took a left, and maybe another 20 feet, and I was taken into a room to the right. Now, this room that I was taken into was very odd, very weird, shaped very strangely. It had the center of it bowed in like it would if you had a coffee can. and there was a pocket to the left between where this bowed out area would come back to the wall and then the normal wall. There was a pocket there of maybe like an 8 or 10 foot span in between where that rounded area connected and the wall connected to that back wall. And it was the same on the other side. There was something, an apparatus in the ceiling, and there was a table towards pretty much underneath it. And aside from that, there wasn't much in there that I remember. I sat there for a bit, very aware of what was happening, very sharp at this point, very nervous, very scared. And there was what looked like a large ant, is the best way to describe it. And it had turned, moved, got my attention. I was very frightened by that, and I took off to the right side of this bowed-in, canned-in area on the opposite side of where they were. I had run into a hallway. Now, this hallway was absolutely massive. When I say big, it was the center that I came in was like a big circle, which is why the room that I ran out of had an inward bow. And so I would assume any room off that rounded area would have a bowed-in area in it. Now, there were was like set up like a Y. Off to the right, there was right to my right shoulder at this point, out in this hallway, you're looking at a tube or a walkway of some maybe distance of four cars, car length, like a four-lane highway. And then just opposite that, on the top, the other part of the top of the Y, if you will, was set up very much the same. Now, the bottom Y part was probably twice that. So to me, it looked like traffic coming in from the top of these Ys would filter down to the larger tube. And the rounded out area was meant to accommodate traffic. That's what I get from that. Hmm. So wherever this was going, who knows if it was a good spot or a bad spot, but that's the way it looked to me. And I was there for several seconds, and then I was taken. I was brought back in. I sat on this table, and this apparatus came over me that looked like the top of maybe a tanning bed or an MRI machine. It had holes in the side of it. It was made by two different parts. It looked like the two parts separated. And I laid down. It covered me to some degree. I could still see under it. It was not tight on me. And there were oval holes on it, oval holes all the way through this apparatus. And it stopped just before my chin. And there were what looked like raisin packets, large raisin packets with adhesive on it. And these were actually placed on my body, on my leg, my stomach, and on my face.
Were you fully clothed at the time or not?
No. It's pretty embarrassing, but no.
No, you don't have to. You don't have to. That's okay. I do have some questions here for you. So it sounds to me this experience, you had a total recall. Like a lot of times you hear about, you know, regression and, you know, hypnotherapy to get the story. Did you have total recall of this whole situation all along?
Well, yeah. I wouldn't say I have total recall. I'm willing to bet I remember about 20% of it. I mean, I don't remember a lot, you know. I remember segments, you know, fragmented moments. And I say to myself, first of all, there are four of us on that craft. That's what we were. We all have talked about this our whole lives. We all go back and forth. Mm-hmm. We were not made to forget it. I think because we were so young, and this has been something that's been told to us by others in the field, that we were young kids. And if there was something that they wanted to extract or something that they wanted to exchange or mutually exchange, you don't want to drug somebody up and then extract something from them, because you're extracting what you're using to pollute or alter the body before you extract it. So being that we are O negative, and being that my son is so advanced today, which is proven by school records and everything else, it's not me telling you that, we think something was evenly exchanged. Now, if there was something in these packets that were absorbed in our skin, and there was something that was extracted from us at the same time, you wouldn't want to be drugged up. That would have happened first, and then they would have put the packets on you to, for your body to absorb something. And then at the end of the day, it puts you out. One of the packets puts you out. One of the packets is something else, what have you. Your little moment of testing or whatever is completed, and you're brought back into this room which I was standing in, and then we're back in the car. Now, my mother was completely unconscious. My brother was out like a light. My grandmother was the one who first was awake, wide awake, and I found her walking in the middle of the road. Now, she had turned the car around and shot right back into town where our store was, where they made the night drop, because one of the stores was open, the Silks restaurant, convenience store and so on. They sold candy and ice cream. And so when she went back there to get them, that's when we realized how much time had passed, because they were getting ready to close. And so she speaks to the owner of the restaurant, the convenience store, and she gets wrapped up in bikes and strollers and these other things in there, and she's trying to find her way out, and she's not really thinking clearly. I walk in after her, and I'm trying to, trying to get her attention because everyone else in the car is out. And she finally takes my hand, and I walk out of the store with her, and she starts breaking down a little bit, starts to shake and cry a little bit. It was a bad day for her. And she comes over to the car. My mother now is up, and she gets into the driver's seat. My grandmother gets back in the passenger seat. For some reason, they were reversed. My grandmother was in the driver's seat. My mom had been driving earlier, so they were reversed. And my brother starts to come to. And like I say, come to, that's what it was like. It was like we were put out. It was like we were under anesthesia of some type, which is why my father said, he thinks that what happened in 69 was a little closer to home than we realized, that there was a joint effort there, because this was a big place that we were in. Certainly wouldn't fit in scale with what we saw as the craft, and the 2 years earlier. So we don't really know where we were, to be honest with you. We're still trying to figure that one out. But it was a big facility. And we drove home, not a word. My mother switches our room. She changed the rooms, gives us the front room, the master bedroom, actually. Closes off the back room, puts the house up for sale, and we're out of there. And we moved to Great Barrington. And then after my father marries my mother and graduates law school, he gets an offer in the Canaan area and accepts it. And he's a lawyer, and now he's in office for 2 terms. He's backed by Senator Chris Dodd. He's making all kinds of political, friends. And I've had coffee at Governor Weicker's house, or the governor's mansion, I should say. And then my father starts running into Robert Bletchman, who used to work with J. Allen Hynek. And after a couple of drinks, we start talking. I start meeting him on Fridays at his office. He takes an interest in our case. He finds the Hynek classification that it was given in 1969. He tells us he's got something big coming up, which happens to be the United Nations Symposium, in a couple of years. This is probably 89, 90, 18 months down the road. I'd really like to discuss your case. Is your father still in politics? Yes, he is. I don't think he'd appreciate that. And so my father and him being friends, and the fact that we decided if we legally retained him, we would have some control over it. And so I did. I gave Robert a check for $1,500, and he mentioned our case at the United Nations in support of 33-4-26, and he did so very tactfully. And it was really only this only piece of this that he really found of interest, and because he was still talking about the Cash Landerman and the Hudson River Valley case, that the feeling that we had about the environment, how it would just seem to change, and how the barometric pressure seemed to change, and how life would go kind of still and quiet and become like a dead calm, and then your body would pick up on this field or energy and this lighterness and almost a, you know, a gravity, and a, it was very, very strange. It was a vibe doesn't really do it justice. If you took three moons, like you got a full moon out, you have more, you know, full moon, you want to go out and party, stay out later, have that extra drink, and be okay. If you had three full moons, you know, you have an energy about you. It's not anxiety. There's just something that, like your body is made of water. So you almost feel different, you know, almost enlightened. And that is kind of like what it was. There's no way you're going to sleep. And then, bang, it changes, and you're, like, placid, and boom, there's a eruption of crickets. That's what it was like.
Wow. We only have a couple minutes, and what I'm going to do, if it's all right with you, Tom, is I'm not sure how this live stream is going to work. And so I'd like to hold you on in case it doesn't work. I know it's kind of a second fiddle thing. I hope you don't take it that way. But but anyway, is that all right with you?
What do you want me to just hang on?
Yeah, but we're not ready to go just yet because if this is the end, I want you to answer one of the chat room questions. And
sure.
What did the beings look like?
Well, there were two. There were what looked very human to me. They had what almost looked like, you know, skin tight, white clothing, off white clothing. You know, I don't want to use the wrong terminology, but they looked almost like smaller Asian, you know, people with descent with eyeglasses, large eye, you know, type of eye lenses, no hair, and they had a weak chin, but everything else looked pretty human to me.
Wow.
But then there were, not the grays people talk about. I didn't see that. But the insect thing that I've actually drawn at, I found my website.
Yeah, I saw that.
That looked like an ant, a big ant standing on its back feet. It had a gray, long, grayish, mushroom-shaped or colored skin tone to it from the neck down. It had limbs that kind of stemmed, the arms, if it was the arms and the legs, kind of stemmed from the same lower part of the body. They're very stick-like, and in my sketch, the lines in it are more like a gray, but they were more like a wine color, you know, like a red wine color rings on it. And the head was more like a bronze gold, and it seemed very smooth. It didn't seem like the eye popped out of it. It almost looked like it was a smooth, sphered head, but the size of a football.
Wow.
And, of course, Alien Mysteries gave it, you know, buck teeth and everything, but I didn't see any of that. It just looked like a goldish football.
Yeah,
it did. Stupid. But like, it wasn't odd enough. Like a football-shaped head that was smooth. Eyes were all just like an ant. You know, you could probably, or like that of a snake's eyes. You know how they're, like, open all the time, but they just look like they blend right in? Like that. And it was about 4 feet tall. Had a little bit of a teardrop body. And it had, like, human hands. So people have said to me, well, that sounds pretty odd. Well, but then we're splicing monkeys with jellyfish now, and we have spiders that were grabbing the DNA from that and incorporating it into a cow to make spider silk, which is like a powerful type of material now that the government's using for bulletproof vests. And, you know, we're playing with species here. So it occurs to me now I can talk about it better because it doesn't sound so far-fetched anymore that, you know, what we saw looked like a big spider. But then again, if I said to you, you know, how big is the average bird, you'd probably tell me a couple of feet wide. But then again, if you go back to prehistoric days, they had 38-foot wingspan. So just because something's an inch tall here doesn't mean it's an inch tall somewhere else. I mean, we have midgets that are 3.5 feet, and we've got basketball players that are 7.
Right.
So It basically looked like I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it looked like someone took some human DNA and made an intelligent spider that could perform tasks that would be almost impossible for a human to do, because we're not very strong.
Right, not compared to an ant. Yeah.
Now they can jump 20 feet. The spiders are all over.
Hey, so, Tom, we didn't get to talk about much. And so if you want to hang on for just a minute, because I'd like to have you back. But let's just see if this other show is working. So just hang on just for a second.
Absolutely.
And I'm not hearing a thing. Let me just refresh here.
Am I on or off?
You're still on. We're still live. And but I'm just not sure how his
Blog Talk Radio.
I think that's it. I don't know.
Yeah, if you guys.
Here we go. Hang on just a second. So, Tom, I want to thank you so much. The other show is going live, and we're going to tap into that. Thanks so much. We'll have you back on.
Yeah, please do. Thanks again, everybody.
All right. You take care, and I'll be talking to you soon.
All right. Good night, buddy. Good night.
So that's it for this part of the show. Remember, you can listen to the second half of the show, or the full show, I should say, for just as low as $1 a month. And you can go to our website, podcastufo.com, and right on the sidebar, there's a banner you can click, and all the information is right there. I want to thank everyone for, well, I should say, if you can't support our show, I still appreciate you as a listener. I want you to know that. So I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Alejandro Rojas with the news. We had three guests. We had Tom Reed. And our second guest was actually a live streaming and monologue, basically, Randy Nickerson. And after that, we had Walt Kalinda down at Cape Ann Auctions down in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Good guy. Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse and Bruce Rainier for our music. Thank you. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. Remember, you can like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news and astronomy news. You can check us out next week on the Dark Matter Radio Network, the full show live, and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky.